I don't know how to cut ladies' hair. I'm not a lady. Listen, dear. She grabs his scissors, lops off one of her braids, and says, Now fix it. Lord love ya, girl. The other men glanced up from Chinese checkers at her entrance. They raised an eyebrow when she plopped down in the barber's chair, and now they grin at her. That's the stuff. Satchelash shakes his head and does his best. I don't know why you don't go into Sydney to a proper beauty parlor. The checker players chuckle and lisp and call him Pierre. I don't got time to be gallivanting off to Sydney, says Frances, savoring her new gun mall grammar. I got things to do. 20 minutes later, she emerges onto Plummer Avenue, her head a bobbing mess of rusty bedsprings. Canada just got another sweetheart. She swings into McIsaac's drugs and confectionery. Hello, Mr. McIsaac. May I please have a packet of pins? I like your haircut, Frances. It's right jazzy. When he turns, she swipes a pack of Turkish tailor-made smokes. He hands her the pins along with a lemon drop and asks her, What are your plans when you graduate next year, lass?
Why, I think I'll go in for teaching, Mr. McIsaac. I believe it is most important that children get a good start in life, and that's what a good teacher can give them.
You're smart, you girls. You've a gift, each and every one of you.
She pops the lemon drop into her mouth and leaves the pins on the counter. She enters the schoolyard throng at morning recess. Frances has decided that today is her last day of school. If she isn't expelled after what she plans to do, then there's no justice. She lights a cigarette and looks around for the means to her end. Inside, Mercedes is washing a blackboard. She looks out the window to see her sister smoking right out in the open. And what on earth has Frances got on her head? A strange little cap of hair. Good Lord! By the time Mercedes gets outside, Frances has taken off somewhere with Puss Eye Murphy. What can she possibly want with poor sweet Puss Eye? Actually, Puss Eye mutated into Pious Eye some time ago. Until now, most people call him Pious or Father Pie. So certain is everyone, including himself, of his priestly vocation. So Mercedes stands on the school porch, beating chamois against the stone steps, unable to shake an uneasy feeling, even though she knows that any girl would be perfectly safe with Cornelius Father Pie Murphy. When the bell rings to signal the end of recess, Puss Eye staggers from one of the derelict outhouses on the edge of the playground and runs sobbing through the games of shinny, skipping ropes and hopscotch, across the street into the ballpark, all the way home. Why is he holding his crotch? Mercedes scans the sea of pupils for Frances and spots her strolling away from the outhouses. What in heaven's name has happened? Students pour up the steps and past Mercedes, speculating as to the nature of Francis Piper's latest crime.
Kicked him in the nuts. Put a snake down his combinations.
Mercedes watches till Francis is out of sight. Then she takes a deep breath, collects her brushes and chamois, and returns to class, hoping for the best. That afternoon, James receives a note from Sister St. Eustace. Frances has been expelled. Midway through supper, Frances arrives home and joins her family at the kitchen table.
Boiled mush with mush.
Lily is amazed at the sight of Frances's shorn head, but before she can comment, James excuses her and Mercedes from the table. They set down their knives and forks and leave without a word. James stands and raises his hand. Frances doesn't wince. She doesn't even look up. None of her involuntary muscles contract in expectation. She just reaches for Lily's fork and starts eating. James lets his hand drop to his side. He says, suddenly tired.
Don't bring it home.
She just chews. He carefully moves the plate out of her reach.
Do you hear me, Francis?
She looks up, affecting good-natured distraction. What's that?
If you're going to live here, whatever you get up to, keep it away from Lily.
Francis reaches for the plate and says, Don't worry, Daddy. He feels more than tired as he looks at her. The insolent face, the freshly hacked curls. Lost and gone forever. What happened to her?
My little Francis.
James sighs. He can't think about all that right now. There is too much of it. It's too dark in there, and he doesn't have the energy. He watches her, elbows on the table, humming as she chews. Then he leaves without having laid a hand on her.
She's as beat as she'll ever be.
Frances told Puss Eye she needed his advice about a terrible sin someone had confessed to her. Once inside the darkness of the boonie with its antique reek, Francis knocked him down, and with a fistful of his hair and her knee gouging his breastbone, she jammed her other hand down his pants. She grabbed and jerked while he cried. The harder he got, the harder he cried. He couldn't help either one, and it didn't take long. He was only 15. Francis wiped her hand on the floor and left. Mission accomplished. It's not like I hurt him or anything. Puss Eye's mother knew at the sight of him when he arrived home. He didn't have to say much except to name his attacker. His father was dead, lucky for Francis, and Petal was far away. Widow Murphy went to the school and told Sister St. Eustace, in as few words as possible. If there was any lingering faith on anyone's part that deep down Francis was good, it has been obliterated. The next morning, Mercedes arrives at school early as usual and has just enough time before the bell to fill a bucket with soapy water and wash away the cinder scrawl on the side wall, Francis Piper, burn in hell. Cheap women and cheatin' men. Put another nickel in the Nickelodeon. All I want is having you and music, music, music. I'd do anything for you, anything you'd want me to. All I want is loving you and music, music, music. Now that there's entertainment, men start bringing the occasional date to the speak. Jamil sets up a couple of tables, puts on an apron. The women watch the show with varying degrees of disbelief, scorn, or fascination, while their men affect indifference. Frances has gutted the player piano of its music rolls, and she hammers away at the keys, at first playing Mama's old vaudeville music from the Hope Chest, and then by ear from the records that sailors bring her up from New York City. Frances is a bizarre Delta diva one night, warbling in her thin soprano, moonshine blues and shave 'em dry, declaring an octave above the norm, I can strut my pudding, spread my grease with ease, 'cause I know my onions, that's why I always please. The following Saturday we'll see her stripped from the waist up, wearing James's old horsehair war sporran as a wig, singing, I'm just wild about Harry, in pidgin Arabic. She turns the freckle on her nose to an exclamation point with a stroke of eyeliner, rouges her cheeks, paints on a cupid's bow mouth, and dances naked behind a homemade fan of seagull feathers. I wish I could shimmy like my sister Kate. She invests her early profits in faced paint and costumery. She'll start out as Valentino, in a striped robe and turban. While one hand teases the piano keys, she removes the robe to reveal Mata Hari in a haze of purple and red. The seven veils come off one by one to Scotland the Brave, and just in case anyone's in danger of getting more horny than amused, there's always a surprise to wilt the wicked and stimulate the unsuspecting. For example, she may strip down to a diaper, then stick her thumb in her mouth. "Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy, so I simply couldn't be bad." Her act is fueled by jazzoline. For at first, Frances takes most of her pay in liquid form, till she gets wise. Drink is just a means to an end. It inspires her one-woman follies, and it makes her untouchable when she takes the men outside one by one, because the real money is not in the speak. It's out back. Frances is a sealed letter. It doesn't matter where she's been or who's pawed her. No one gets to handle the contents, no matter how grimy the envelope. And it's for sure no one's going to be able to steam her open. Frances will bounce in your lap with your fly buttoned for as long as it takes for $2. Expensive, but consider the overhead in wardrobe alone. A hand job costs $2.50. She has a special glove she wears, left over from her first communion. Another 50 cents buys you patter, a song, any name you want to hear. Touch her little chest and cough up an extra buck, nothing below her belt. That's the menu, no substitutions. If she laughs at you, don't whack her, or she'll holler for Boutros. Frances starts to make money. Once she has acquired enough trinkets and trash to keep her gussied, she starts saving her money in a secret place. It's for Lily, not for a cure. Frances does not subscribe to Mercedes' devout yearnings. In fact, Frances is unsure why she is sure the money is for Lily. She is putting it away just in case. In case what? In case. Frances remains a technical virgin throughout. What is she saving herself for? She can't say. It's a feeling. There is something left for her to do. For Lily. What, Frances? Something. Every night when the last drunks are being peeled off the floor and deposited outside, Frances passes through the tired curtains to the back room and changes. One night, early in her career, she tiptoed up the back stairs and discovered her Aunt Camille sitting in a kitchen, playing solitaire under a dim yellow bulb. Again, Frances was struck sad by the sullen heap, so like and unlike Mama. Camille was too absorbed in her cards to notice Frances peering around the door jamb. Frances watched Camille sip her tea and cheat. Frances can't help but wonder how Camille wound up here, married to Jamil. But then, look where Mama ended up. Maybe Camille eloped too. Frances's reflections on the subject of romance are summed up by the last scene of Pandora's Box, when Louise Brooks finally gives it away to a fella for free. He ups and kills her. Frances has no desire to penetrate any further the shabby mystery of Aunt Camille, so she hasn't repeated her foray into the upper domestic reaches of the speak. Come closing time, she removes her costume among the crates and kegs of the chilly back room and washes her face and hands at the pump. She never washes the costumes. She climbs into her beige woolen stockings, her black button boots, girl guide uniform and beret, and heads back to New Waterford. Lily is always faithfully at the window, ready with the sheet, even though Daddy never gets home before Frances on weekends anymore. James doesn't want to be there when Frances sneaks in or out. He doesn't want to know where she goes. In the mornings, he glances into her room, half expecting to find her gone. Run off with a man, perhaps. Perhaps dead in a ditch. "Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair," rasps Frances, and Lily lowers the knotted bedsheet. Frances is usually fairly sober by the time she climbs in the window, unless she has nicked a jar for the road. "Want a sip, Lily?" "No, thank you,"
Come here, dollface.
Lily steps onto Francis's feet, and they spin about while Francis sings.
Let's dance. Though you've only a small room, make it your ballroom. Let's dance.
Mercedes stands in the darkened doorway, spectral in her white nightgown.
Join me in a nightcap, Toots.
Francis, you're drunk.
Francis rattles. The sheet is slit, who slit the sheet, whoever slit the sheet is a good sheet slitter.
Say it fast, Lily.
Francis, it's time to go to bed.
Mercedes tries to sound calm and bossy at the same time.
Piss on you, sister.
Francis laughs. Occasionally, if she's feeling up to it and Francis is sufficiently intoxicated, Mercedes will seize her around the waist, carry her to the waiting tub and bathe her forcibly, uniform and all. Otherwise, Francis would not be fit to live with, for she only ever washes her face and hands, and she never washes her uniform. Mercedes rifles the guide pouch in search of soiled hankies, but finds only a dirty white glove.
Where's your other glove, Francis?
I only use one.
Oh, well, it may as well be clean.
Mercedes wrings it under the hot water, asking,
Isn't it rather small for you now?
It does the trick.
Mercedes does not inquire further. On relatively sober evenings, Francis curls up next to Lily and whispers whiskey in her ear.
Lily, we are the dead.
Lily pretends to be asleep.
Except we don't know it. We think we're alive, but we're not. We all died the same time as Kathleen, and we've been haunting the house ever since.
Lily prays for everyone in case Francis is right. On quite sober evenings, Lily confides her fears.
Francis, do I have to go to Lourdes?
No, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do.
Lily tucks her little foot between Francis's ankles.
Francis, Al Akbar Inshallah. Infala inti itsy bitsy spider. Yakusa gingerbread boy kibba. Shalom bi salami. Aladdin bi sesame. Bazella ya aini Beirut. Teberini.
Teberini.
Tipperary.
Every night, pissed or stone sober, Frances puts her money in the secret place for Lily. Lady Bountiful. Mercedes graduates top of the class in 1930. Ralph Lvovitz is second. Mercedes gives the valedictory address, in which she urges her fellow young citizens to learn from the mistakes of the past, to seize the numerous challenges of the present, and to put their trust in God and His only begotten Son, our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. James sits near the back of the auditorium with Lily and the Lvovitzes. It's inadvisable for Francis to be seen near the school premises, so she is absent this evening. Although earlier in the day, Mercedes entered her bedroom to find a new boxed set of Morocco-bound The Complete Charlotte Bronte on her dresser.
Oh, Francis, the expense, the dubious source of the requisite funds, the generosity.
Mercedes cried and hugged Francis and told her she loved her. Francis told Mercedes not to leak all over her uniform. After the commencement ceremonies, Mercedes, Lily, and James repair to the Lvovitz house for tea. Lily wonders again, but does not ask, why all the mirrors are always covered in Mrs. Love's house. Mercedes and Ralph play happy, sad klezmer music on piano and clarinet, while Mr. Lvovitz sings and dances to the delighted embarrassment of Mrs. Lvovitz. As Mercedes and Ralph's heads incline closer over the old Yiddish songbook, Mr. and Mrs. L. exchange complicated looks across the parlor. James doesn't notice. He simply enjoys the music, unaccustomedly relaxed. A civilized evening with old friends. We should do this more often. He savors a feeling of normalcy for the first time in years. In the increasing absence of Francis, it has become possible for James, now and then, to feel like a good man.
Have another arugula, James.
Thank you, Ben. Don't mind if I do. They're delicious, Mrs.
Ralph escorts them home and lingers on the veranda with Mercedes. He tells her he is going away. Not for good. They can write.
Promise me you'll write, Mercedes.
Of course I will, Ralph.
His parents have scrimped and saved to send him to McGill University in Montreal.
I thought you were going to St. FX.
Mercedes keeps her voice steady. St. Francis Xavier University is only a day away by train. It's where she plans to go, when her family can spare her. But Montreal.
It's a great opportunity.
Of course it is, Ralph.
He's leaving next week. It's all very sudden. He's going to live with the Weintraubs, friends of his mother's relatives who recently emigrated from Munich. They've lined up a job for him in a bakery. Ralph is going to be a doctor. He is a scrupulous boy and so does not make any rash proposals of which he is as yet unworthy. He will wait until he has finished his undergraduate degree. Then he will ask Mercedes to be his wife.
Mercedes?
Yes, Ralph.
Mercedes' heart beats so rapidly that she fears it has set the ruffles of her yellow silk blouse aflutter. Ralph leans abruptly down and brushes her lips with his own. Then he is away, leaving Mercedes breathless. Upstairs, she cools her cheek against the scarlet leather of her brand-new edition of Jane Eyre. Mercedes and Ralph exchange fervid, newsy letters all that summer and through the fall. Their correspondence gives Mercedes strength to endure, to postpone the beginning of her life. She has turned down her scholarship to St. Francis Xavier University, for how can she think of leaving home when Lily is still a child? Mercedes is so accustomed to doing everything for Daddy's sake that it seems natural to assign this sacrifice to him as well. But deep down, another purpose has been emerging. Francis needs looking after. More than Daddy, more than Lily. What if I were far away at school in Antigonish and Francis didn't come home one night? In the meantime, Mercedes is not at a loss for worthwhile work. She has her project, Lily. There have not been any more overt signs since the night of Lily's illness last November. Mercedes does not include, indeed tries not to notice, the reddish highlights that have since appeared in Lily's hair. And she reminds herself that miracles alone are not sufficient to indicate that special closeness to God, which is sainthood. The life, too, will be taken into account. To this end, she redoubles her charitable efforts with Lily in tow. The abundance of free time on Mercedes' hands, now that she is no longer at school, dwindles to a pittance once she has scheduled the needs of her community. She learns a valuable lesson. If you think you are good, just try doing good. You'll soon find out how inadequate your little drop of goodness is, especially in a mining town, especially in the Depression. Mercedes bends with grim determination to her mission. If it were enjoyable to immerse oneself in the malodorous misery of the less fortunate, it could not be counted a sacrifice. Offer it up for the poor souls in purgatory. And remember, time is of the essence. Saints who are revealed in childhood rarely live to adulthood. Lily's life has already been painful, and Mercedes expects it to be short. She prays. Lily need only survive to celebrate her 14th birthday. In the Lord's tin, there is almost $30. Mercedes has observed Lily's particular gift with the veterans. On the top floor of the pleasant west wing of New Waterford General Hospital, there live a handful of men whose injuries and lack of family have rendered them permanent residents. Some have no arms or legs. Three were gassed. They are perfectly fine and whole other than their lungs. They sit quietly near the window, wearing their oxygen masks till the sun goes down, and it's time to lie perfectly still in their oxygen tents. Their eyes have enlarged, and the lines have dropped away from around their mouths behind the masks. They look like big children. Maybe that's why they like to see Lily coming. They are child grown-ups, and she is a grown-up child. Lily doesn't flinch when she meets the man with no face, just a blank stretch of baby skin with nose holes and a lipless mouth that doesn't quite close. He doesn't mask his missing face because he never goes out, and everyone on the ward is used to him. What's more, he can't frighten himself. He has no eyes. His great pleasure is a cigarette, and now touching Lily's face. He has found the bump in her forehead, and it amuses him. He swears he was uglier before, and shows Lily a picture to prove it. Lily agrees that he was putrid-looking, and he laughs. Mercedes notes this as worthy of inclusion in the life of Saint Lily. For Mercedes has never known this man to do more than grunt an obscenity, much less laugh. Lily is not repelled by the veterans. She feels badly for them. They have been terribly hurt. But pity is a poison unction. Lily has experienced pity, but she didn't know what to call it. She only knew it made her terribly afraid, as if she had disappeared and become a ghost. Having experienced her own disappearance, she is conscious of how important it is for people to be seen. So when she looks at them, even the blind one, she also looks for them, just in case they too have got lost and need finding. They play gin rummy until she learns poker. The gas men are the only ones who never laugh, though they enjoy themselves. On the way home, when Mercedes quizzes her, Lily always feels she has somehow let her sister down when she answers truthfully, "I had fun." Every evening, when the day's ministrations are done, Mercedes indulges herself with a gloriously blank sheet of paper. "Dear Ralph." There are things Lily could tell Mercedes that would have quite another effect, but it never occurs to her to do so. For example, Mr. McIsaac has stopped drinking. He tells Lily she has healed him. He tells her she has the gift. It happened one day when Lily asked to see where he grew the medicine. Mr. McIsaac took her back to his greenhouse. Mr. McIsaac is also a veteran, though of the Boer War. Too bad it was a bad war. He has said there's no such thing as a good one. He and Lily both limp on the same side, and he likes to tell her they'd run one heck of a three-legged race together. He tells her how like she is to her beautiful sister Kathleen. God rest her soul. Especially now that the red is coming out in her hair. Fairy hair, Mr. McIsaac calls it, a twinkle in his kind, bleary eye. Don't worry, lass. That's a good thing. They went through a canvas door into the greenhouse. The air was mysterious to breathe, damp like an underground lake. There were plants in boxes everywhere, each with a special power, but none, it seemed, that could cure him. But the miraculous thing was overhead. Lily looked up at the glass roof. The sun came out from behind a cloud and filtered through the tiny panes. Before her eyes, a host took shape. Shadows of green and gray. A ghostly army in uniform, smiling down at her.
forever young. Glass photographic plates. Mr. McIsaac collected them. So many were discarded after the war, there being no demand for additional prints of such photos once their subjects had been killed. "They're my children," he said. "We were never blessed with our own. So I think about all the people who lost theirs, and how maybe I'd have lost mine too, anyhow, things being what they were."
Mrs. McIsaac had died earlier that year, and people expected Mr. to follow soon at the rate he was going, constantly, quietly soused. Lily said,
"I'll be your child."
He laughed his wheezy laugh, then covered up his face. He reached for her hand and placed it on his bald head. After a while, he gave her back her hand and looked up again. He asked her to do something for him.
"Whenever you pass by my door, say a Hail Mary for me. Will you do that?"
Lily promised she would, and she did. Still does. She didn't tell anyone because it seemed private. Soon people were saying it was a miracle that Mr. McIsaac had quit the bottle, even though there was barely a soul in town who didn't know him money. There was no one who wouldn't rather see him spry behind his counter. McIsaac would live long enough to extend credit right through the Great Depression and die a rich man on paper. Lily did not feel disloyal to Daddy when she told Mr. McIsaac she would be his child. Francis would say, "That's because Daddy's not your real father." But Lily knows he is. Just as she knows that it is possible to love everyone the most, even if she can't help loving Francis most of all. The Ginger Man. Jamil has been charging admission on show nights. He makes Boutros wear a fez. He has replaced the faded curtain with a beaded one. There are ashtrays. There are glasses. He ups the price of poison. He's still paying Francis a nickel a night. In September, he has the nerve to demand a cut of her earnings from her private customers. What he gets is a new deal.
"Look, buddy, I've turned this dump into a cultural mecca. So don't you be talking to me about cutting you in. You're cutting me in, pal. I'm in for 50% of the door, or I walk and talk."
"Fuck you."
60.
40.
Au revoir.
He grabs her arm.
45.
Kiss my arse.
50.
Give me a light.
He lights her cigarette.
"All right. You're in now. Say if you foul up, I'll cut your throat just like I would a man's.
Get me a decent piano in here."
Boutros neither confirms nor denies Jamil's threat. He just counts out half the evening's admissions and hands it over to Francis.
"Hey, Boutros," she says. "I didn't know you could count, by."
She winks at him and heads for the back room to change out of her diaper and marry Widow. In a place like this, it's best to get a man's status. The threat of throat cutting and only throat cutting simplifies a woman's survival. Francis trades in her coins and $2 bills for larger notes at the bank in order to fit it all into her hiding place. When the sweetheart of Whitney Pier turns 17, there's a cake and presents and everything. The clientele, which has grown more checkered along with Francis's reputation, sings happy birthday. A woman whom Francis calls the Countess because she looks like the lesbian in Pandora's box gives her a one-way ticket to Boston. The Countess has got a big education and some kind of setup down there. She's described it to Francis 1,000 times, but Francis, though she keeps her eyeballs pointing in the same direction no matter how much she's had to drink, still can't get it straight whether this woman runs a nightclub or a home for wayward girls. "My intentions are entirely honorable, Fanny," says the Countess, at which Francis yawns in her face and winks. A stoker named Henry gives Francis the latest Bessie Smith, Black Mountain Blues. She gives him a big sloppy kiss, then holds her hand out for a quarter, and everyone laughs. Archie, White Sox McGillicuddy, who everybody knows is a sissy boy, comes wearing his thing outside his pants, gaily gift-wrapped with a bow and a tag, for Francis. Francis tells Boutros to open it for her.
Go on, Buttress. Good things come in small packages.
Boutros declines. Leo Taylor shows up at the front door in time to see Jamil parading through the crowd bearing a pint-sized painted whore with a parasol on his shoulders. Taylor yells over the din, "Mr. Jamil, I got you what you ordered." Jamil sets Francis down, and numerous hands cover her eyes before she can turn around.
"Who turned out the lights?"
Boutros leaves with Taylor. After a few moments, they return, veins bulging in their necks, inching a good-as-new upright piano through the door. Taylor delivers the booze on weekday afternoons, so he has never seen the place in action, which has been just fine by him. He dislikes drunks, and prostitutes dismay him. They are all someone's daughter. This one is small enough to be a child, but surely that's impossible. He is just as glad that her face is obscured by someone's hands. There is no missing the oversized red ringlets of her wig, however, or her hands spinning the parasol, lily white to the wrists, where two sleeves of grime begin. Grime that has accumulated through contact with nothing but time. And he can't avoid her scent as he sets down his end of the piano before her. She smells like a neglected baby. That sad sour milk pea stain smell. Taylor leaves and comes back with a piano stool. But she's already seated with her back to him, demurely rendering "Let me call you sweetheart." It disturbs him. Such a little girl voice. Francis doesn't miss a sweet beat as Boutros gets up off his hands and knees and is replaced by the stool. Leo Taylor leaves feeling a bit sick. The steel door closes behind him, and he hears the piano become a piany as Schmaltz transmogrifies to boogie. He steps up into his truck and starts the engine. He would like to go home and kiss his wife and kids again for the road, but there's no time. Along with liquor, he's hauling live lobsters to New York City for all the fine old families and newly minted gangsters who can afford them. He points his truck south on Highway 4 and conjures his wife's voice and image to keep him company. He calls up every precious detail. Rusty wire hair, dark brown freckles across her light brown face, sharpshooter eyes. Lean and mean, it makes him chuckle. They commune all the way to the Strait of Canso, till he's off the island and he figures he ought to let her get some sleep. "Good night, Addie," he says, smiling at how she'd razz him for his sappiness, if she could see him chatting to her out loud in his truck as it rolls onto the ferry boat. He sees her wry smile as she reaches up to kiss him. "Good night, Ginger," she says. "Drive safe, baby." Leo Taylor is not called Ginger because he is a light black man. He is dark like his sister, Teresa. He is called Ginger because he brews real ginger beer from a West Indian recipe passed to him by his mother, Clarice. Clarice used to sell it, but Ginger can afford to give it away as a treat. He has the strong arms and soft belly of a happy man. He often counts his blessings, wondering how he got so lucky in life. A good job, healthy, beautiful children, and a tough wife. That night, Francis crawls into bed next to Lily as usual, but before long awakens from another nightmare. There are dreams Francis is used to by now. like the one where she gives her own amputated leg to Lily, but it's the wrong size. There are dreams she'll never get used to, where she puts Lily in the oven by mistake and cooks her, but Mama doesn't seem to notice that the roast is Lily, and neither does anyone else at the table. But tonight, Frances awakens with her throat constricted in a silent scream. Mama in the garden on the scarecrow stick, wearing the old fedora and one of her baggy flowered dresses all crusty down the front, and she's holding the steak and kidney pie scissors with a bit of pink gristle hanging off. But the worst part is she has no face. Mama! Frances is determined not to watch to the end of this silent picture, in case it becomes a talkie. She needs to sleep in a place of no dreams, a place both empty and utterly silent. The attic, being in a state of permanent shock, is both. Trixie follows as Frances drags a blanket and a pile of cushions across the hall to the door of the attic stairs. She opens the door, but both she and Trixie hesitate. The problem is that, although the attic is not haunted, the stairs leading up to it are. Frances stands barefoot at the bottom, looking up into the narrow passage. She feels a tightness at her scalp, as though she still has braids. In the darkness, her body distends and contracts wildly, as though she were an elastic band, suddenly 10 feet long and curved, then very small like a young child.
I forgot to put my house coat on.
Frances sees her green tartan house coat in her mind.
But that's silly, because I haven't had that house coat since Mercedes and I were little, and everything matched.
Frances is on the first step. A wet chill down her spine restores her body to its normal size, and she is seized with fear because she can hear voices. Just below the water, they are still fish voices, but they are bubbling to the surface. In a moment, she will understand what they are saying. Frances starts babbling quietly with her hands over her ears and forces herself onto the second step. Damp shadows slip her by. Kathleen is up there.
No, she isn't. That's just the kittens. Stop! They have to be baptized. Don't!
Who's the killer?
Don't!
You're the devil.
Don't!
All the way up the stairs till she gets to the top and opens the door. Arriving in the attic is like arriving in the desert after almost drowning. She closes the door behind her. Trixie leaps silently onto the window ledge. Frances lies on the floor. She closes her eyes and sleeps deeply and blankly. No longer any need to fear death by dreaming. Frances awakens the next day more sober than she's been in almost a year. She finds a train ticket to Boston in her guide pouch, but doesn't remember how it got there. She goes to the station in Sydney and scalps it for cash. She has no intention of leaving the island until she has made enough money for Lily, and accomplished something else, too.
What, Frances?
Something. She will know it when she sees it. She is a commando in training for a mission so secret that even she does not know what it is. But she is ready. Every night, the obstacle course. Maneuvering behind the lines. Camouflaged to blend with the terrain.
Your voice is sad whene'er you speak. The night before the war ends, Kathleen unties an emerald sash from around the waist of her scandalous new dress of pale green silk chiffon, and winds it round and round the brim of her lover's charcoal fedora. She runs her hands up the diamond-studded shirt front and slips her thigh between the stripes of the wide black and tan pant legs. There are mixed clubs they can go to uptown, and there is a private place in Central Park. They have to be careful, but it's hard. They are so young, they forget that the world is not as in love with them as they are. And tears bedim your loving eyes. Book 6. The Girl Guide. Don't Whine. By May 1931, Mercedes is downright worried. She hasn't heard from Ralph in 8 weeks. She won't ask Mrs. Lvovitz about him, because it is unladylike for a girl to seem to be pursuing a boy, and Mercedes doesn't want to appear fast, especially in the eyes of her future mother-in-law. And besides, if Ralph were in trouble, his parents would know, and they appear to be quite unperturbed. Nonetheless, Mercedes drops into Lvovitz's kosher Canadian several times a week, the darndest items having slipped her mind. "Oh, Mrs. Lvovitz, would you believe I forgot to pick up a pound of blood pudding for Daddy?" One Thursday afternoon, Mercedes returns to Lvovitz's to buy a box of salt she forgot that morning. As Mrs. Lvovitz rings up the purchase, she smiles a little oddly at Mercedes and inquires, "Well, now, and how's your father, dear?"
"Oh, he's well, Mrs. Lvovitz, thank you."
The two of them nod and smile at each other, yet neither makes a move to leave. Mercedes asks, "And how's Mr. Lvovitz?"
"Oh, you know, mister. He's grand, dear, just grand."
Mercedes chuckles and nods. Mrs. Lvovitz asks, "How are your sisters?"
"Lily is grand, thank you. And Frances seems... well, I worry a little about Frances. She's still finding herself, you know."
"We all worry, dear, but she's a... deep down, you know, she's fine."
"Thank you, yes."
Mrs. Lvovitz reaches for a tin of Ovaltine and hands it to Mercedes.
"Have you ever tried this?" "This we get from England."
"Oh, really? No, I never have."
"Here, try it. You'll like it."
"Oh."
Mercedes reddens and reaches for her purse, unsure as to... but Mrs. Lvovitz places a hand on hers, and in the familiar scolding voice that puts Mercedes back at ease,
"Aye, aye, aye, what do you think you're doing? Put your money away now."
Mercedes says, "Thank you very much, Mrs. Lvovitz. That's awfully nice of you," and feels foolish, aware she must be thanking Mrs. Lvovitz rather too profusely, because Mrs. Love's smile has turned a bit pink. In fact, Mercedes has never before seen such a sustained smile on the dear lady's face. Mercedes smiles back, longing to ask, "Have you heard from Ralph?" Instead, she thanks Mrs. Lvovitz once again and turns to leave. But Mrs. Lvovitz pipes up,
"Have you heard from Ralph?"
Mercedes turns back. Now she is truly worried.
"No, I haven't. Oh, dear.
He's fine, he's fine. Our friend's right, he's fine. He's perfect. It's just..."
"Oh, well, that is good news. We haven't had a letter from him, and I wondered..." "Oh, dear."
They look at one another a moment. Then Mercedes shakes her head.
"I'm afraid I haven't had one in quite some time, either."
Mercedes is both bewildered and embarrassed by what follows. Mrs. Lvovitz squeezes Mercedes' hands between her own and says, with her chin wrinkled in a smile against tears,
"You're a good girl, Mercedes. A wonderful girl."
"Thank you, Mrs. Lvovitz."
Mercedes drops the Ovaltine into her net bag and almost forgets the salt, adding,
"I'll let you know as soon as I've heard from Ralph."
But Mrs. Lvovitz has turned back to the shelves and is carefully straightening a box of steel wool. 3 weeks later,
The longed-for letter arrives. Mercedes carries it up to her room, taking the stairs an unaccustomed two at a time. She flings herself onto her bed, kissing the envelope before her head hits the pillow, and spends a moment lying on her side just caressing the seal. "Dear Ralph." His features have smoothed, and his voice has deepened in her mind over these past many months. She sighs, catches sight of her red cheeks in her dresser mirror, and commands, "Don't be such a silly chit, Mrs. Ralph Lvovitz," which makes her giggle, and she hugs her pillow and buries her face in it at the same time. Finally, she composes herself enough to open the letter.
"Dear Mercedes, dear Ralph, I feel conceited even writing this to you because you are such a swell girl and could have any fellow in the world instead of settling for me anyhow. But I feel I had better say it because maybe you'll think I'm a coward if I don't. Here goes. I am terribly sorry if I ever led you to expect..."
When Mercedes can get up, she crosses to her dresser and removes Ralph's picture from the frame to reveal the poem with which she replaced Valentino's picture almost 5 years ago. She returns to her bed and sits perfectly still, willing all her leaping blood back to low tide, until, even if she tried, she could not so much as make a fist. Little by little her temperature drops as she stares at the words of wisdom in the frame, erasing Ralph. By evening, she is perfectly calm. Lucid, in fact, for the first time since she conceived her little crush on the grocer's son.
A Hebrew. Heavens! Meanwhile, there are those who need me, whom I have neglected.
Mercedes walks downstairs with her head perfectly balanced on her neck, one hand lightly gracing the balustrade. Tonight, Francis will get a bath, no two ways about it. Mercedes enters the kitchen, goes directly to the Lord's tin, and counts the money.
We'll have to do better than that now, won't we?
She lights a burner on the stove and dispatches the crumpled photograph of the boy with sticking-out ears. She cooks a large supper for Daddy. It pains her to realize how she has neglected her culinary duties of late. And Daddy is so kind about it, saying only,
"I'll pick up some cold cuts on the way home, Mercedes. Don't you go to any trouble."
Mercedes plans to keep the table groaning from now on. Poor Daddy. Mercedes has told no one of the letter. So when Mr. and Mrs. Lvovitz drive into Sydney for the joyous reunion with their son early in June, they are unprepared to meet his wife. Marie-Josée is petite and plump in just the right way. Dark and pretty. Catholic and pregnant. This dire accident in no way obscures the fact that she and Ralph are very much in love. Don't whine. Today I saw a lovely girl with golden hair, envied her and wished I were so fair. When she rose to go, she hobbled down the aisle. She had one leg, wore a crutch and a smile. O God, forgive me when I whine. I have two legs, the world is mine. Then I stopped to buy some sweets. The lad who sold them had such charm. I talked with him. My being late was no harm. As I left, he said to me, "You've been so kind." "You see," he said, "I am blind." Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have two eyes. The world is mine. Later, I saw a child with eyes of blue, watching others play, not knowing what to do. "Why don't you join the others, dear?" He stared ahead. He could not hear. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. Author unknown. Dark Ladies. Frances is changing into her guide uniform in the freezing back room of the Speak, one March night in 1932. Although she feels the cold more than many people, she welcomes it because it makes her outfit seem so fresh. Tonight she gets a bit of a start. A flaccid female voice plops against her like a jellyfish.
"You're no good."
Frances looks up. The darker patch of gloom is unmistakably Camille.
"Oh, hi, Aunt Camille.
You're trash."
Frances pulls on her ripe woolen stockings.
"We're all sisters under the mink, honey.
Why don't you kill yourself?"
Frances bursts out laughing and leaves. At first glance, in her guide uniform, it's hard to believe Frances is 18 and not a child of 12. At second glance, it's hard to believe Frances was ever a child. Camille watches her go and wonders,
"What did my sister ever do to deserve that? But then, what did I ever do to deserve my life?"
When Mahmoud's eldest daughter, Materia, ran off with the Anklis bastard, Mahmoud gave his second eldest daughter to Tommy Jamil, thinking that his being Lebanese was enough. It was not enough. Mahmoud knows that now. Jamil is no son-in-law of his. Luckily, there were three daughters left, so he was able to make up for the first two. They're all happy. Two married nice Lebanese-Canadian boys from Sydney, and the youngest married a doctor, Anklis, but a good one. And his sons all married well. Three got wives from the old country, which is ideal. Three married Canadian girls, one Lebanese, two Acadian. One son is a priest. God is great. That makes 40 grandchildren so far, 24 of whom are Mahmoud's, and 15 of those are male.
Menshkor Allah.
Camille could have had her pick of husbands. She really was the most beautiful in that many sons sort of way. She could have been Camille McNeil, Camille Shabib, or Camille Stubinsky. Instead, she is Camille Jamil. She doesn't blame Pa. Pa, she reveres. And how could she blame Materia, whom she idolized? So she hates Frances, the slut who lives only to dishonor the memory of poor Materia. Camille is a simple woman who wanted a simple life. Instead, she got a complicated one. She giggled and batted her eyelashes, and where did it get her? Jamil's gin joint. Pa gave Jamil a big dowry. God only knows where that money went. Camille is not talented. She would have been good at the things she was raised to be good at. The world should not be organized to require heroines, and when one is required but fails to appear, we should not judge. We should just say, "Poor Camille. She turned into a bitch the way most people would have, and stay out of her way." In her heart, though, there is still expectation. A clearing in the woods. Not when she looks at her five sons, who were absorbed by their father as soon as they were big enough to carry a crate or run with a message. Not when she looks at her husband, who never even bothered to shave on their wedding night. He examined himself and the bedsheet right after to make sure he hadn't been cheated. No. The clearing in her heart is where Camille pauses like a deer and waits for Pa to see her. The following night, the inky specter waits once again in the back room. Frances actually gets a bit nervous. Camille is the type of woman who sits like a lump, then picks up an axe one day.
"Hi, Aunt Camille. What can I do for you?"
"You're shit."
"My, that's a lovely ensemble you're wearing."
"You're a disgrace to my father."
"How's he doing? I keep meaning to drop by."
"You're not fit to set foot in my father's house."
Frances snaps shut her bulging guide pouch and leaves. Camille has just given her an idea. The address is in the phone book. Frances finds her way to a house on the hill. She flits from hedge to tree, from shrub to sidewall. The coal chute is just big enough for a child. Once she is inside her grandfather's house, there are quite a number of secret vantage points, and plenty to steal. One hardly knows where to begin. There is a grate on the inside wall of the opulent front room. Frances's face can often be seen there through wrought iron vines, but no one ever thinks to look. The closet beneath the stairs is full of soft, dark things. When its door stands open a crack, it is possible to discern a thin white stripe interrupting the sliver of gloom. That's Frances peeking out. Hands seeking furs and shawls have brushed right past her curls, hardly pausing to register them as just so much more mouton. And if, one night, the occupant of the master bedroom upstairs awoke and looked under the bed for no reason, he might see her lying there with her arms folded across her chest, staring up at the spot where his heart sleeps. That is, if she is not peering at him through the brass bars at the foot of the bed. Frances drinks in her grandfather's long, lean frame, his skin the tone and supple texture of aged deer hide. She can't see Mama anywhere but in the color of him, in the liquid ebony of the eyes, though his are sharp, and the waviness of the steel-gray hair. She is pierced with a sudden longing for her grandmother, and wonders how it is possible to miss what you never had. She is surprised to locate one family resemblance, however. There is something of Mercedes in the angles of Mahmoud's body, his carriage an immutable spine. Frances concludes, not for the first time, that she herself is a changeling. She always brings back a present for Lily. A sterling silver tail comb with tortoise-shell teeth, a moonstone ring, a braid. Lily strokes the dry black braid as though it were a creature prone to sudden death by fright. "It was Mama's," says Frances.
"Can I keep it?"
"It's yours."
"Where did you get it?"
"I found a trap door like in Arabian Lights. It leads to an underground garden. There's everything you can think of down there just growing on the trees. Jewels, hair, and babies that haven't been born yet." Lily assumes this is Frances's way of talking about the old French mine. She doesn't like to think of Frances there alone, looking for treasure, robbing the dead. Lily begs to accompany her, but Frances says the Arabian garden is a solo mission. When Frances brings Lily back a single pearl, however, Lily starts to worry because it means that Frances has been diving. She is afraid Frances might decide to drown in the pool at the old French mine. Lily knows how tempting it can be to breathe water, so she asks Ambrose to watch over Frances.
"Please, dear brother, deliver our dearest Frances from drowning as you delivered me."
The first time Frances stayed out all night, Mercedes was frantic. She changed in and out of her nightgown, wrung her hands, and several times was halfway out the front door. But with no idea where to search, she soon returned to her vigil at the kitchen table. Besides, what if Frances should telephone while she was out? Mercedes did her fretting silently, so as not to worry Daddy, who was in a much-needed and uncharacteristically deep sleep in the wing-back chair. In the morning,